From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Those hearts broken when the cruel January winds blew away the yard lines are now uplifted by weekend matchups like Arkansas-Monticello at Southeastern Louisiana, Valparaiso at Murray State, and Wofford at Air Force. Ahead on Only a Game, a college football season preview, and the story of the NFL's wartime conglomerate, the Philpott Steagles. Also ahead on Only a Game, Jack Kerouac bobblehead night comes to a minor league baseball park in the author's hometown.
You know, never once did, we'd ever think it would reach worldwide attention. Never in our wildest dreams. And, like we said, sometimes you get lucky, and we got lucky.
Stay tuned.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Carol Van Dam. Iraqi police say they have arrested two Iraqis and two Saudis in connection with the bombing of Iraq's most holy Shiite mosque. A top police official says all four have ties to Osama bin Laden's al-Qaeda terrorist network. The official says the four were taken into custody shortly after yesterday's car bombing. The death toll has risen from yesterday's powerful bombing in the holy city of Najaf. Authorities now say at least 95 people were killed. The bomb was detonated shortly after Friday prayers ended. Among the dead is esteemed cleric Ayatollah Mohammed Bakir al-Hakim. NPR's Ivan Watson is in Najaf. He says the explosion is considered one in a string of major setbacks for the U.S. occupation of Iraq.
Many of the locals were blaming the U.S. for not being able to provide adequate security to prevent such an explosion. Just 2 weeks ago, we had the United Nations headquarters, which was devastated by a truck bomb. 2 weeks before that, the Jordanian embassy that was hit by a similar type of car bomb. And in Najaf itself, less than a week prior to this explosion, a respected Islamic scholar who was a relative of the man who was assassinated, he was injured by a bomb. And if there was already enormous uncertainty about the future, now people are predicting things as extreme as possibly a holy war, though they don't know which factions might fight it.
NPR's Ivan Watson reporting from Baghdad. The World Trade Organization has given its approval to an agreement that allows poor countries to import cheap drugs to fight life-threatening diseases. The deal means patents owned by multinational corporations can be set aside and poor nations can import inexpensive generic drugs to fight AIDS, malaria, and other life-threatening illnesses. The Russian Navy reports the loss of a nuclear submarine today. It sank with a skeleton crew of at least 10 aboard. The BBC's Stephen Eek has more from Moscow.
Russian naval authorities say the submarine was carrying a crew of 10. Two bodies have been retrieved and one sailor rescued. The fate of the other crew members remains unknown. A spokesman for Russia's Northern Fleet said the submarine had been decommissioned 14 years ago. He stressed that there was no danger of radioactive contamination as the submarine's reactor had been neutralized and that it was not carrying weapons. The submarine was being transported to Russia's Murmansk region, where it was to be dismantled. The military prosecutor has opened an inquiry into the accident, which comes just 3 years after Russia's worst-ever naval disaster, in which 118 sailors lost their lives.
The BBC's Stephen Eek in Moscow. A Russian cargo ship is heading toward the International Space Station today. The ship is carrying oxygen and food, along with other supplies, to the crew of the orbiting outpost. The station is dependent on Russo-Cargo cargo ships since the Columbia disaster. This is NPR. After completing six-way nuclear talks in Beijing, North Korea says today it is not interested in participating in more talks and has no choice but to strengthen its nuclear deterrent for self-defense. The comments come from the North Korean Foreign Ministry spokesman. He's quoted in Pyongyang's official news agency. The talks ended yesterday. Officials from the U.S. and four other countries had hoped the Beijing conference would lead to more talks. The number of Americans traveling on the nation's highways during this Labor Day weekend is expected to be the highest in nearly a decade. Jerome Vaughn with Detroit Public Radio has the story.
The American Automobile Association says nearly 34 million people plan to drive to a destination at least 50 miles away from home this weekend. That's an increase of more than 2% compared to last year and the highest number since 1995, according to a survey conducted by the organization. A spokesman for AAA says heavy security at airports and fewer flights offered by airlines have pushed more travelers to drive rather than fly. The organization says the number of people planning to fly over the Labor Day weekend is down more than 2.5% from the same period last year. The increase of motorists on the roads is also helping to raise gas prices. Heavy consumption, coupled with supply disruptions, have dwindled gas supplies, pushing the national average price per gallon to $1.75. For NPR News, I'm Jerome Vaughn in Detroit.
President Bush returns to Washington today after a month-long vacation in Texas that was interspersed with fundraisers and re-election campaign appearances. The president condemned yesterday's bombing, as he has with other attacks in Iraq. Mr. Bush has said the bombings will not deter U.S. efforts to fight terrorism. I'm Carol Van Dam, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Kresge Foundation, building capacity with challenge grants since 1924, on the web at kresge.org.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants. Since 1985, offering discerning patients and dentists options for same-day replacement of missing and compromised teeth. Information online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The sport that's known around the world as football is a game where you don't use your hands, you use your feet. But all the same, the game that's known as football here in these United States is landing, as it does each year at this time, on our plates. So buckle up your pads and jam your helmets on your heads. The time has come for hitting men and not just blocking sleds. Joining me now to rescue us from that desperate rhyme and get down to the business, and I do mean the business of college football, is Ivan Maisel, who covers the game for ESPN and ESPN.com. Ivan, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thanks, Bill, and I think since it's college football, you need to say business.
I'm sorry. Terrible and silly mistake. Business, of course. The Ohio State Buckeyes' surprising victory over Miami in the national championship game last January was due in large part to the play of running back Maurice Claret. Since then, Claret has had a number of problems we don't have time to describe, including allegations of academic fraud. The school will announce the length, I guess, of Claret's suspension next week. How do you see this finally panning out?
Well, it won't be pretty, Bill. Claret's got a number of issues in terms of suspensions. He's got a false police report. He has already admitted it was false, that he filed concerning a break-in of his car. He's got some issues that they've been very cryptic at Ohio State, but they say pertain to amateurism, which means improper benefits, which means some sort of payment or gift he shouldn't have gotten. And then he's got a wholly separate investigation concerning his academics and whether he crossed the line and got breaks because he was a student athlete. So he will be gone at least three games and most assuredly more.
How do we like Ohio State's chances, given that this guy's missing for at least some portion of the season?
Well, I don't think that their chances of repeating are all that good. I mean, part of it is the scrutiny that's put on a number one team, as we've seen with the big coverage of Claret. Part of it is just they had a lot of breaks last year, and God bless them. You know, it doesn't mean your ring is any smaller or the T-shirts are less bright, but you just don't get that many breaks 2 years in a row.
The University of Alabama had a tumultuous and somewhat embarrassing offseason that included resignations, firings, and strippers as well. 38-year-old Mike Shula, the Crimson Tide's third coach in 9 months, is the second youngest coach in Division I. Is he the guy that turned things around in Tuscaloosa?
Well, that's his job. I'm not sure he was the best guy. I thought they should have hired Sylvester Croom, who was a Green Bay Packers assistant, former Alabama player as well, and would have been the first African-American head coach in the SEC. Would have put Alabama on the front page for all the right reasons. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Shula is there. He's never been a head coach. That said, from all reports, August practice has gone very well, and they're quite optimistic about this season.
Meanwhile, Auburn, which is Alabama's arch rival, is picked by many not only to win the Southeastern Conference, but maybe to contend for the national title as well. And you're in a pretty good place to tell me about Auburn, I understand.
That's right. I am in Auburn. They play USC this evening. Auburn is really looking good. They've got everything you want in a national champion contender, a good offensive line, probably the four best tailbacks in the country. And a veteran defense led by two very good linebackers, Dontarius Thomas and Carlos Dansby.
Now, this is the last year before Miami and Virginia Tech leave the Big East for the ACC. It more or less means the end of the Big East as a national power in football. But perhaps the irony is, in its last season, the Big East has never been more competitive. Do we see another team overtake the Hurricanes and the Hokies this year?
Well, there is a candidate. The Pittsburgh Panthers are looking very good. They've got one of the smartest head coaches in college football, and Walt Harris. He's a quarterback guru from way back. Their quarterback, Rod Rutherford, has been his project the last two, 3 years. And they've got a wide receiver, a sophomore named Larry Fitzgerald, whose name you will hear for a long time on Sundays.
We've discussed a number of title contenders, and we could perhaps have added Oklahoma, Texas, and USC to that list, but is there a clear-cut favorite as far as you're concerned?
Yeah, to me it is Oklahoma. They have a tremendous defense. The NFL scouts go out in May every year and look at the upcoming seniors and then announce who they project as first-round draft choices, and three Oklahoma starters have been predicted to be first-round draft choices next April. And,
wow.
You know, there's not but 32 first-round picks, so that's a pretty hefty percentage. The offense is okay, but they proved 3 years ago that you can win a national championship with an okay offense as long as you have a great defense.
Okay is Oklahoma, after all.
There you go. Rodgers and Hammerstein on Saturday morning.
Nicely done.
Yeah.
Ivan Maisel covers college football for ESPN and ESPN.com. Ivan, thank you again.
Thanks, Bill.
Thursday night's game between New York and Washington will mark the official opening of the 2003 NFL regular season. Fans following the league's 84th season might find it difficult to imagine, but 60 years ago, the NFL came close to folding. But the league was saved in part by the temporary melding of Keystone State mashers who came to be known as the Steagles. Matthew Algio reports on a most unusual chapter in pro football history.
During the Second World War, the National Football League faced a crisis unimaginable today, a shortage of players. By 1943, so many players had been drafted into the armed forces that the league was forced to temporarily fold one team, the Cleveland Rams, and merge two others, the Pittsburgh Steelers and the Philadelphia Eagles. The combined team was officially named the Phil Pitt Eagles Steelers, but almost immediately fans and headline writers dubbed them the Steagles.
We managed. We had a lot of fun. We enjoyed it.
Frank Bucko Kilroy was a rookie lineman on the Steagles in 1943. He was also in the Merchant Marines at the time, and he had to take a train from his base in New York to team practices in Philadelphia.
It took me an hour and 20 minutes, and I'd hang up my uniform and go out and work for 2 hours. But the moment that football season was over, I was on the North Atlantic in convoy duties.
Most of the Steagles, though, weren't on active duty. They were 4F, unfit for military service. Center Ray Graves was deaf in one ear. Tackle Vic Sears had ulcers. And Tony Bova was blind in one eye. They worked in defense plants during the day and practiced at night. Al Wistert was a rookie tackle on the 1943 Steagles.
Some of us, for one reason or other, physical problems, I hope they were all physical, were rejected from service. And I was one of them. I had broken a wrist and had to have it operated on a couple of times to try and get it fixed, but it's not even fixed till this day. But we were kept out of the service, and so we cheerfully played professional football.
But merging two teams presented some problems. For example, where would home games be played? The league decided the Steagles should play 4 home games in Philadelphia and 2 in Pittsburgh. Then there were the head coaches. The Steelers' Walt Kiesling and the Eagles' Greasy Neal were named co-coaches. an arrangement that Wistert remembers was less than ideal.
I can remember one day when Greasy Neal got all upset and he threw his arm full of plays that he had down on the grass field and stomped off the field. He was quitting. So it was pretty bad, I'll tell you. They didn't get along very well.
However, Wistert says the players did get along. The merger seemed to foster a special camaraderie that showed on the field. Despite being cobbled together from the remains of two mediocre teams, the Steagles managed to put together a winning season. They finished 5-4-1, just one game out of first place in the NFL's Eastern Division. It was the first winning season in the history of the Philadelphia franchise, and just the second for Pittsburgh.
Oh, say can you see by the dawn...
The NFL recently commemorated the 60th anniversary of the Steagles at a preseason game in Pittsburgh between, appropriately enough, the Steelers and the Eagles.
Steeler fans, please welcome home the 1943 Pittsburgh Steagles.
6 of the 9 surviving Steagles, including Bucko Kilroy and Al Wistert, were there. They stood at midfield, old men basking one last time in the appreciative applause of football fans. Kilroy, who was the general manager of the New England Patriots in the 1970s, says there will never, ever be another merger like the one that created the Steagles.
Being an ex-general manager, I would say no way could it ever happen. Not with the egos today. You couldn't have it.
The NFL disbanded the Steagles after the 1943 season, and the Steelers and the Eagles went their separate ways. In 1944, the Steelers merged with the Chicago Cardinals, and the results were disastrous. The Card Pits, as they came to be known, finished 0-10. By 1945, though, the war was over, and Pittsburgh had the Steelers all to itself once again. For Only a Game, I'm Matthew Algio in Pittsburgh.
Life is fun with my baby on the swing shift. So divine with my baby on the swing shift. She's the nuts, they're among those nuts and bolts, with 100 million volts shining from her eyes. She's a Lockheed bomber.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing to us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org.
She's nearby in the fuselage.
It's 18 minutes past the hour. Last weekend's plan to shatter the record for world's largest group hug failed for the most elementary of reasons, lack of huggers. Only 69 people showed up at Pouch Cove, an amusement park in Newfoundland, for the assault on the hugging mark. Rain may have been a factor, or perhaps people in Newfoundland are insufficiently silly. In any case, the current group hug record was set by 4,703 Boy Scouts attending a jamboree in Sweden. David Snow, the owner of the amusement park and organizer of the disappointing group hug, refused to be disgruntled. In fact, he was downright gruntled. "I think we set a record for Pouch Cove," Snow said. "It was fun."
I want to hug you and kiss you, sweet to the arm follow.
I'm Steve Brown with the sports headlines. In yesterday's American League action, Boston doubled up the New York Yankees by a score of 10-5. Toronto clobbered Cleveland 7-3. Detroit avoided their 100th loss of the season by virtue of the Tigers' 8-4 triumph over Chicago. And Anaheim beat Kansas City 10-3. Elsewhere, Minnesota toppled Texas 8-5. Seattle stymied Baltimore by a score of 3-2. And Oakland was better in the Battle of the Bays, topping Tampa 5-2. For Only a Game, I'm Steve Brown in Boston.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, parts 43 and 44 of our series on geeky sports, in which Jack Kerouac gets a bobblehead doll and Rubik's Cube world champion Daniel Knights jumps from an airplane. But first, the second round of the 2003 FIBA America's Olympic qualifying basketball tournament is over. Today in San Juan, Canada will play Argentina, and Puerto Rico will face the U.S. to determine not only the matchup for tomorrow's gold and bronze medal games, but also which of those three teams will play in the 2004 Summer Games in Athens. Joining us now on the line from San Juan is Chris Thomason, who is covering the tournament for the Rocky Mountain News. Chris, welcome to Only a Game.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Canada has played well under the court leadership of Dallas Mavericks point guard Steve Nash. Now Canada faces Argentina to see if they move on. Which do you like?
Well, I like Argentina. They beat the U.S., of course, last year in the World Championships in Indianapolis, which is kind of what started this widespread panic about what's become of U.S. basketball, and things spiraled downhill, and the U.S. lost three games in that tournament. And they gave the Americans a great game the other day, losing only by 8 points. Argentina, though, has a tendency to kind of relax. They, believe it or not, lost to Mexico and Venezuela. Mexico at the start of the tournament, Venezuela later on, but they really want to play the U.S. again, so I like Argentina in that game tonight.
In semifinal game number two, the host team will try to upset the U.S., which it failed to do on Thursday in the second round. Puerto Rico lost 91-65, but any chance that via that loss, Puerto Rico has figured out the U.S.?
Well, if they figured them out, they already would have. They played a preseason game, an exhibition game at Madison Square Garden a week and a half ago as well, and they scrimmaged against each other several times. I wouldn't be surprised if Puerto Rico just kind of sends up the white flag maybe and rests some folks, because they're gunning to try to win the bronze medal game, which will also give them an Olympic berth. They know they're not going to beat the Americans.
The U.S. team mantra has been remember Indianapolis, as you've already suggested. That was the site of last year's World Basketball Championships, and the U.S. was badly embarrassed by Argentina, Yugoslavia, and Spain, and came in ultimately sixth. Though the U.S. has gone undefeated in the first two rounds this time around, the team hasn't exactly cast aside all doubt. Can they be upset still?
I don't think they can be upset, but I think the real test will come in the Olympics next year, because Yugoslavia, which is now Serbia, Montenegro, will be better than ever, I think. They'll be able to fight with the United States, I think. It was definitely a wake-up call last year in Indianapolis, but I think American fans have to realize that the landscape is changing. It's been 11 years since the 1992 Dream Team crush teams by 50 or 60 every game, and then after the game, the players would ask the U.S. players for autographs,
right,
and take photos with them. It's a different landscape. Granted, with the exception of Argentina, which the U.S. won by 8, they've won all of the other games here fairly decisively by 25 or more generally. But the games have been tests in the first half. I mean, they've trailed the teams in the first half, such as Brazil and Mexico, and egads, they were even down to the Dominican Republic by 5 points in the second period. So things definitely have changed, the landscape has, but I expect the U.S. to win the gold medal down here this weekend.
I suppose the only prognostication left to make then is which of the four remaining teams will fail to medal and thus be the last team eliminated from the opportunity to play in Athens.
I think it'll come down to the bronze medal game, Canada and Puerto Rico, and I like Puerto Rico. I like the home court advantage here. It actually wasn't as big against the Americans Thursday. It was kind of funny. You had all these Puerto Rican fans who are wearing Allen Iverson and Tracy McGrady jerseys, yet cheering for Puerto Rico. So it's kind of a bizarre scene. I guess it's a little bit like the United States playing Georgia or something like that, or playing Arizona, because obviously Puerto Rico is part of the United States. So the fans weren't as raucous against the U.S., but I would imagine in a bronze medal game with an Olympic berth on the line, the fans would be crazy, and that's why I'll take Puerto Rico for the third berth.
Chris Thomason covers the FIBA America's Olympic qualifying basketball tournament for the Rocky Mountain News, and he joined me on the line from San Juan, Puerto Rico. Chris, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
On the evening of August 21st, the Spinners, the single-A baseball team in Lowell, Massachusetts, enjoyed a standing-room-only crowd. This was not a surprise. The Boston Red Sox minor league affiliate had spun a string of 151 sellouts going into that Thursday night game, but John Good, the director of public relations for the Spinners, was taking nothing for granted. He'd arranged for a promotion in which the ball club would give away bobblehead dolls of one of Lowell's most famous native sons, author Jack Kerouac, to the first 1,000 people to buy tickets. The promotion had folks lining up outside LaLasher Park nearly 8 hours before game time. Even John Good, who figured he was onto a good thing, was surprised.
We thought this would be a nice little community promotion. You know, we get the city behind, the university behind. You know, never once did, we'd ever think it would reach worldwide attention. Never in our wildest dreams. And, like we said, sometimes you get lucky, and we got lucky.
Good did, in fact, get bobbleheaded inquiries from Kentucky and California, among other far-flung places. But closer to home, the Kerouac doll was not unanimously appreciated. Two young women named Crystal, both from Billerica, a neighboring town, were not sure what they were being handed when they bought their Spinners tickets. And by game time, Crystal number one had already unloaded Bobbling Jack.
Sold it some guy.
For $5 in this book.
In a book.
He gave you the book the road, and you gave him the bobblehead doll, and he gave you $5.
In a book, yep.
So you're going to read it?
No. Go sell it on eBay.
I don't even know who he is.
We don't even know who he is.
The two Crystals acknowledged that it was the players who'd brought them to the ball yard that night. That was why they were sitting in the first row of box seats. Jack Kerouac would have understood. Still, even the two Crystals and other fans who didn't know the work of the beat novelist and poet Lowell is proud to call her own were bound to learn something just by being at the game. In addition to the bobblehead giveaway, the Spinners had arranged for John Sampas, Jack Kerouac's brother-in-law and the man in charge of his literary estate, to toss out the ceremonial first pitch. After he'd performed that duty, I caught up with Mr. Sampas under the grandstand, and I asked him if he'd be looking for a giant spike in sales of his brother-in-law's work.
Well, I don't know if that's going to happen, although that would be very nice, but I wouldn't count on it. I wouldn't go out and buy a new car.
Funny, Jack probably would have, or an old car, maybe, and then he'd have handed the keys to Neil Cassidy, and off they'd have gone, headed at top speed for whatever coast they weren't on. Or at least that's the way it would have been in Kerouac's younger days. But how would the writer, who died in 1969 at the age of just 47, have felt about being memorialized in bobbling plastic? I asked Meg Smith, who's involved in the annual Lowell Celebrates Kerouac Literary Festival, whether the promotion at LaLasher Park might trivialize Kerouac's work. She thought not.
I can understand how some people would have that concern, but the way that I look at it is that Kerouac is as much a part of the popular culture as he is literary culture, if you will. And I think it can be seen as an opportunity to have something tangible to maybe introduce people to his works or get them interested in it. And, you know, certainly for them to see that he actually was a real person, you know, who was born here and lived here. And I think it does add to the fun, actually.
At least as much fun as the Jack dolls was the opportunity to hear the poet over the PA system between innings, though that part of the promotion provoked even more puzzled looks than the giveaway had.
It's been so long since I've been hungry. It's like a miracle. Ah, boy, but them bacon and them eggs.
The Sports Connection, the honoring of Jack Kerouac at, of all places in Lowell, the ballpark, was no stretch, according to Professor Hillary Holliday, who teaches courses that include Jack Kerouac's fiction and poetry at the University of Massachusetts at Lowell.
He was a wonderfully fast typist, and he was proud of that. He considered that one of his sporting activities among many.
And he was an athlete.
Yeah, he loved baseball. He invented his own baseball card game as a kid. He was a great football player. He was also a track star in high school. And a lot of people don't realize that. So it kind of makes sense to honor Kerouac at his hometown baseball park.
And this can only help.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely.
And I assume you'll have a Kerouac bobblehead doll on your desk the next time you lecture about the Dharma bums are on the road.
I may have to glue it down.
She may have to do just that. By the middle innings of that Thursday night game, the Jack Kerouac bobblehead doll was inspiring much talk of commerce. It was beginning to look as if the crystal from Bill Ricca, who'd given up her bobblehead for a copy of On the Road and $5, had been had, at least according to the experience of John Meehan of Lowell, who was offering the Dharma bums and $10.
No, I haven't found a ticket yet, no. They all want to go over on eBay and sell them out on eBay.
Here we go. Here's a transaction. Come on. As of the middle of this week, it looked as if those refusing to deal away their bobbleheads had indeed chosen wisely. Jack Kerouac bobblehead dolls were going for as much as $250 on eBay. And somewhere, one has to suppose, Jack Kerouac is laughing.
Snuck up pretty fast, snuck out of the past. Oh, Kerouac, you're on the top of my shelf. With this trash, put up with the gas. You live through it all.
Last weekend in Toronto, Daniel Knights became the world's champion at solving the Rubik's Cube, which means he did it more quickly than anybody else could do it. That anybody is still fiddling with the Rubik's Cube may surprise some. After becoming one of the world's most popular toys in the early 80s, the infuriating puzzle went out of production in 1985. But apparently the cube is back, and we have its champion on the line from San Leandro, California. Daniel Knights, congratulations, and welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks. I appreciate it.
For those who aren't familiar with Rubik's Cube, it's made up of squares of various colors. Lines of the squares can be moved around the cube, and the idea is to achieve a cube where each side is of a single color. Did that achievement come easy to you the very first time you picked up a Rubik's Cube?
Well, the first time I played with it, I actually was teaching a computer program how to solve it for a programming class. So I was using a book, and it was really easy to pick up for me, but, you know, I was just following the instructions in the book.
That leads to a very obvious next question. Once you could solve it by doing it from a book, what made it fascinating to do it yourself?
Well, I had a roommate who used to do it in about a minute, and he and I were just sort of being competitive in a friendly way, and I was sitting there on the first night that I had the cube with the book in my lap, timing myself, and I would reference the book when I didn't know the algorithm, and it was taking me about 4 minutes.
Well, how quickly did you solve the puzzle in order to win the world championship?
We actually had to do an average of 3 tries, and that's to make sure that someone didn't just have a real lucky go or a real unlucky go. And so my average of those three was 20.00 seconds.
Now, I understand that you once solved the puzzle while free-falling to Earth before the parachute opened. Is that right?
That's correct. That was really part of my training regimen. I knew long before this competition that the winner was going to be the one with the best nerves.
Mm.
Because we all can solve it really fast at home, but it's another thing to do it when you've got 15 television cameras and documentary cameras all focused on you.
I see.
So I convinced VH1, the cable channel, to pay for me to jump out of a plane and speed solve the cube before we opened the chute.
I see. And how long did that adventure take? Obviously not too long.
Well, it was fast enough. But it took me about 30 seconds. It was a lot harder. It was hard to even hold on to it when you're falling at 130 miles an hour.
I understand you once also, or at least once, perhaps more than once, surrounded yourself with pretty girls in order to distract your attention from the cube. Is that right?
Well, I was a little bit misquoted on that. I was just, one of the things I'll do is when I'm cubing in public, I don't mind sitting near a table of some attractive women, and inevitably they'll watch me while I'm practicing, and that makes me nervous. And that gave me a real-life opportunity to practice recovering from that stress or recovering from the fight-or-flight syndrome.
Part of your training, I understand, involved visits to a hypnotherapist. Did that help?
Yeah. Actually, I attribute much of my success at the competition to this work I did with her. And I actually sat down next to her by coincidence on the subway a few weeks ago.
You were cubing in public, I assume.
I was cubing in public, mm-hmm. and she's a, you know, happens to be attractive, but it came out that she works with performers to reduce stress mm-hmm. during performance. So she made me this custom CD that contained a hypnosis session, and I've been listening to that every night. I even listened to it on the day of the competition in the isolation room when I was preparing to go.
The Rubik's Cube boom back in the early 80s was enormous. More than 250 million cubes were sold within just a couple of years. And I gather we're in sort of a cube boomlet these days. But do you worry that the cube's popularity will fade again as quickly as it did 18 years ago? And if that happens, what does a champion cuber move on to?
I think even if the cube dies out again, I will still love the cube and I will still have a cube. And it will always bring me the happiness that it did in the past.
Daniel Knights is the world's champion at solving a Rubik's Cube. He joined us from San Leandro, California. Daniel, thank you very much for speaking with me, and good luck.
Thanks, Bill. Take care.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced. Additional support comes from Thermo Electron, the scientific instruments company with a mission to advance drug discovery, improve manufacturing, and protect people and the environment. On the web at thermo.com. And from Nutter, McLennan & Fish, working to solve critical legal issues on local, national, and international levels. Information at Nutter.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Senior citizens dance in Miami's Little Havana. Horns blare in the bombed-out streets of Kosovo. And steel drums ring below Broadway and a New York subway platform. I'm Scott Simon. These sounds of our world on Weekend Edition Saturday from NPR News.
I'm Steve Brown with the sports headlines. In yesterday's National League action, the Cubs contained Milwaukee by a score of 4-2. Pittsburgh edged Atlanta 6-5. Cincinnati stopped St. Louis 8-5. Philadelphia flummoxed the Mets 7-0. And Florida edged Montreal 3-2. Elsewhere, San Diego beat Houston 7-1. Arizona vanquished San Francisco 5-4. And Los Angeles downed Colorado 6-4. For Only a Game, I'm Steve Brown in Boston.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, the unlikely achievement of the 1950 U.S. men's soccer team, recollected cinematically. But first, our analyst Charlie Pierce joins me for a look at the week's sports news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
The Athens Olympics are just about a year away, and this week, the possibility was floated that at those Olympics, North and South Korea may compete as one. That would be a remarkable development, wouldn't it?
Yeah, any story involving the Koreas that doesn't also involve the phrase underground nuclear program is a good story these days. The Koreas have been moving towards this for a few since the Olympics in Seoul in 1988, really. And I do remember vividly being in Qatar when, for reasons that are too complicated to explain here, the Japanese needed to qualify for the World Cup soccer in the United States. There was a goal differential between they and South Korea, and the North Koreans in a game against the South Koreans quit, so the South Koreans would make the World Cup in the United States, and the Japanese would be eliminated.
So I suspect I could see this coming
10 years ago, yes.
The NBA story of the week had Larry Bird, president of basketball operations for the Indiana Pacers, firing Isaiah Thomas, late the coach of same. What leads to an NBA coach's dismissal in late August?
Well, when the director of basketball operations doesn't like you, has never liked you, and watched your team sort of roll up and die against the team that the director of basketball operations used to play for in last year's playoffs, and when the director of basketball operations happens to have one of his best friends waiting out there to take over an NBA team, it's only a little bit natural that you would be dispatched. People were estimating that this particular parting of the ways would come about midway through the season, that Isaiah Thomas pretty much had to go, 18-1 with the Pacers to keep his job. It is a little bit odd for an NBA team to lose its coach at the beginning of September. But then again, Rick Carlisle, who, as I said, is one of Larry Bird's best friends and a talented coach in his own right, is out there. He will probably get the job. This is basically two people who could not work together.
Meanwhile, the WNBA playoffs are underway. The top-seeded L.A. Sparks waived one player who was charged with assault, lost another after she'd violated the league's drug policy, and coach Michael Cooper said, anyway, this week, the fire has been stoked. Do we believe?
Well, actually, the Sparks managed to win their last five regular season games and claim a fourth consecutive conference title. And Tamika Dixon, who had been injured, came back and said, we're just starting to get our chemistry back, and that's the key. Well, I guess you find chemistry in interesting places.
This week, Charlie, the assistant coach who would not indulge in ethical compromise and go along with former Baylor head basketball coach Dave Bliss's cover-up scheme lost his job. Serves him right, right?
The story metastasizes almost weekly. Abar Rouse taped Dave Bliss on the 30th and 31st of July, essentially concocting the cover story and slandering a murder victim, which is, as we spoke about before, Bill, it's about as low as you can go, even by college basketball standards, which is pretty damn low.
Yes.
I suspect there's a lawsuit present. I mean, Baylor's insisting that this has absolutely nothing to do with the fact that he taped this guy and was the whistleblower in this scandal, and that this is just pretty much what happens every time you hire a new coach who wants to bring his own staff. But you would think that having done everything else wrong in regards to this story, that Baylor would find a less obvious way to shuffle Mr. Rouse into a job within the university somewhere.
On Sunday, Bill Romanowski of the Raiders punched out a teammate during practice, and he later said that he wished he hadn't done that. So are we worried about chemistry in the Oakland Raiders organization?
Well, this is exactly the way the Oakland Raiders have done business for 30 years, so I don't think Oakland is too worried about it. Bill Romanowski has been a loose cannon, to put it mildly, ever since for his entire NFL career. Marcus Williams, the guy he punched, has a broken eye socket, which is essentially a big part of what has become known as the Rudy Tomjanovich injury. His career may be over. There may be a lawsuit. And I've got to tell you, I don't know when the NFL is going to decide that Bill Romanowski just isn't worth it.
Kobe Bryant, due to go on trial for felony sexual assault within the year, got some support that he would perhaps just as soon have avoided, Charlie. Former heavyweight champion Mike Tyson said he knew what Bryant was going through and added, it can happen to anybody.
Boy, I'll tell you, Kobe Bryant's lawyers must just have, they must have just taken the lock off the liquor cabinet at this point. Just see his, Pamela Mackey, his attorney, returning after a hard day of answering motions and having her assistant go, you know, Ms. Mackey, Mr. Tyson is on the line and would like to join the defense team.
At the U.S. Open, the fans prevailed this week, Charlie. As the tournament began, security guards were under orders to confiscate all food at the gate so that folks watching the tennis would be more inclined to buy club sandwiches for $18 and a half. I gather this injustice simply did not stand.
This particular revolt of the veggie wrap crowd has been coming ever since they moved the tournament from Forest Hills to the palatial expanse of Flushing Meadow. If you think OPEC can raise prices at its whim, you should see the United States Tennis Association. I mean, this is the land of the $6.50 French fries. And strangely enough, one of the guys who was forced to throw the food away at the gate was Pat Cash, who was only a former Wimbledon champion.
In our ongoing search for new and exciting sports upon which to comment, this week we found cricket spitting.
Oh.
They did it recently at Rutgers University in New Jersey. We probably shouldn't be surprised that the winner of the contest was an exterminator.
Well, not merely that, but you have to understand that these aren't like little creepy crawlies that you put in your mouth. They freeze the poor cricket before spitting so that it will
be
attain,
more spittable.
Well, exactly. It will attain the basic consistency of the watermelon seed. Tom Turpin, an entomology professor from Purdue, who has far too much time on his hands, was looking for a way to add to what they call the annual bug bowl, which is apparently an insect competition in Purdue. And somebody mentioned watermelon seed spitting, and they decided which bugs would be good for spitting. And I suppose having eliminated the praying mantis and the elephant beetle, they came up with the brown cricket.
How do you feel as the parent of a college-age offspring when your kid calls from college and says, "Hey, Dad, you'll never guess what my professor's doing."
Well, actually, my particular offspring under question is a roller coaster fanatic. So he would be right there in the front seat with Professor Richard Rodriguez, who teaches English at Loyola in Chicago, who was on a roller coaster for 6 days.
6 days. And apparently that's not his only
now,
achievement.
Now, aren't their entire, like, academic review boards that, like, track down and punish professors who engage in things like being on a roller coaster for 6 days or developing cricket spitting as a competitive sport, and I just spit all over the microphone again?
Charlie Pierce writes for the Sunday Boston Globe magazine and rides the rhetorical roller coaster each week on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
America's greatest victory in men's World Cup soccer will soon be the subject of a major motion picture. No, it will not feature a charismatic bloke with beard aflame or recreate the United States' shocking 1994 first-round victory over Colombia. It will instead tell the story of an American team that stunned the international soccer community 53 years ago. Hillary Wickay of KWMU in St. Louis sat in on some of the preliminary filming, and she has this report.
The year is 1950. The place is Sportsman's Park in St. Louis. The soccer players on the field kick a brown leather ball and wear wool. The fans crowd the wooden bleachers. The men wear neckties. The ladies wear dresses and bright red lipstick.
Harry!
Club players Harry Keough, Frank Borghi, Gino Periani, Charlie Colombo, and Pee Wee Wallace take to the field for a game sponsored by a car dealer and local union.
Cut.
Except it's not really 1950. Hollywood has taken over modern-day Marquette Park and is recreating St. Louis club soccer.
Guys behind camera, we'll keep it nice and quiet. We'll get a good, clean soundtrack. Thank you.
Here we go, ready.
Five of the starting players for the 1950 U.S. World Cup team were discovered in games like these. Four of the guys came from an Italian neighborhood in St. Louis called The Hill, one of the few places in the U.S. that played soccer at the time. The team, put together by a poorly funded U.S. Soccer Federation, wasn't expected to win a single game at the World Cup in Brazil. The odds that the U.S. would beat England, the most dominant team of the time, stood at 500 to 1. But the hastily assembled team managed one of sport's most historic upsets, defeating England and effectively knocking them out of the tournament. Defender Harry Keogh still lives in St. Louis and is now 75 years old.
I said, boy, do I feel sorry for these poor so-and-sos, you know, the other guys, because I said, you know, they're never going to live this down, that we would beat them. One English sports writer always says, you know, I don't mention the game because, he said, you know, I want to forget all about it.
It's exactly the type of David versus Goliath victory that's the stuff of Hollywood.
And action!
It's the stuff director David Anspaugh and screenwriter Angelo Pizzo have experience bringing to life on the big screen. Together they made Rudy, a film about the underdog at Notre Dame. They also created Hoosiers, a movie about the little rural Indiana basketball team that could. Now, with funding from one of the creators of Major League Soccer, The Beautiful Game is getting its feel-good success movie. It's called The Game of Their Lives, and Anspaugh wants it to be the real thing.
And the way we've designed this is that there's no use of trick photography. The shots that we have with our guys, even scoring goals, it's not done with, you know, cuts and, you know, all of a sudden you see some guy's feet and he kicks in your face, and but it's somebody else that's really kicking it. No, our guys are doing all this stuff. The action, I mean, the slide tackles, the headers, the, you know, all that stuff is being done by the real guys.
Play corner!
Ball the ball.
Play corner!
Quickly, get in there.
Corner, guys, corner.
Anspaugh admits he knew virtually nothing about soccer when he started the project, so he hired consultant Eric Winalda, a veteran of the U.S. national team and one of the first American players to find success in a premier European league. Together, they auditioned 6,000 actors who could play soccer and soccer players who wanted to act.
Zach, find him. Let's go. Find him. Turn.
Good. Again.
Winalda was exacting.
I was dubbed Dr. No at the beginning of this thing because I didn't let anybody. I actually cut Louis Mandelaar the first time. Then he actually has been on the Australian national team, so, I mean, it was kind of difficult to make this team.
Actor Zachary Bryan plays Harry Keogh. Bryan has played soccer since age 6 and went through the Olympic development program, but he says Winalda's one of the toughest coaches he's ever had.
There were a couple shots where I chested off and I scored the goal, but it wasn't like a pretty goal. So he kept making me go and do it and do it, and finally I just nailed it. And I knew the second I got the one that Eric wanted. And I remember as soon as I hit the goal, I screamed, yeah, like totally happy because I scored this goal.
Good shot!
Actor Gerard Butler, who grew up in Scotland, can't remember a time from age 3 to 22 that he wasn't playing soccer. But for this movie, to play the part of Frank Borgie, he had to learn to play goalie.
That ground was baked hard some of the time. And I was diving. I landed in some awkward ways, and then one day my back just completely seized up. I couldn't move for 4 hours. I've hurt my hand, I've hurt my leg, I've hurt my back. But that's all cool, you know. I mean, goalkeeper is the craziest position.
It was a position the real Frank Borgie was delighted to play. Now 78, he says even in his younger days, he wasn't the best runner or kicker. He just wanted to play the game with his friends.
I just try to play my position and to keep my eye on the ball, which is the main thing in any sport, you know, and I enjoy doing it. And I enjoy grabbing crosses from the wing. I just like to do that, you know. And I was not a kicker. I couldn't kick like a lot of these goal miners do now. And they kick 60 yards, so I had to throw the ball most of the time, and I managed to throw pretty well. So it worked out pretty good.
It worked out legendarily. In Game 1, the U.S. team performed better than expected, losing to Spain 3-1. As they took the field with England in Game 2, the U.S. team's morale was high, and in the 37th minute, Joe Gaitchens headed the ball into England's net. For the rest of the game, England kept the pressure on the American goal, but keeper Frank Borgie was everywhere. Actor Gerard Butler has heard the stories.
The Brazilian fans, there's a particular name they gave him, but it was something to do with God. They say he must have come from heaven, or he was a god, because there was the English, again, were all over the Americans for most of the game and pretty much camped out a lot of the time in the U.S. box and just fired in shot after shot. they could have scored 10 goals, but they couldn't get it past Frank. You know, he just used, you know, his head, his feet, his hands, his body, anything to stop the ball going in. You know, it seems to have been an amazing, amazing performance.
The Brazilians called him El Magnifico, the Magnificent One. Frank Borghi.
I kept looking at the American team, the bench, and I seen guys putting their fingers up 2 minutes to go, 1 minute to go. And I remember saying to myself, I look at the referee, and he had the whistle in his mouth. I said, darn it, blow that whistle. And then before you know it, he blew the whistle, and then the fans just jumped down off the playing field. They were all excited.
The Brazilians carried El Magnifico off on their shoulders. This would be the time in any heroic story to bring in sound of the crowd cheering and chanting. But the man who owned the film rights for the tournament didn't bother filming the Americans. There are hardly any photos. And only one American reporter covered the game, a St. Louis Post-Dispatch writer who took vacation time and paid his own way to Brazil to watch the boys from St. Louis play. When the final score crossed the wires that day in June, many sports editors figured it was a mistake. Harry Keough wasn't surprised by that.
Like I told somebody one time, I'm glad we didn't win 2-0 because I'm having a hard enough time explaining how the hell we even won 1-0. Because everybody's saying, how could you guys beat them? They were much better than we were.
Actor Zach Bryan says after losing their next game, the Giant Killers quietly returned home.
These guys walked off an airplane, didn't have one reporter, didn't have one newspaper person or whatever. They got off the plane and basically went back to their normal lives. I don't know. I mean, it just goes to show that what soccer kind of meant to the United States back then.
Harry Keough returned to his job at the post office. Frank Borghi went on to run a funeral home.
When we got home, it was kind of, you know, ho-hum. You know, somebody said, hey, Harry, was that a professional team you guys beat from England? You know, I've heard that from a lot of people who should have known better.
Ready, background and action.
Keough might find his life to be a little less ho-hum when The Game of Their Lives is released nationwide in the fall of 2004. For Only a Game, I'm Hillary Wickay in St. Louis.
Many a tear has to fall, but it's all in the game, all in the wonderful game. Let me know that love.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is Michael Garth. We had help this week from George Hicks. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a tape of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15 postpaid. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear this program again, sign up for the Only a Game newsletter or check out Billerica Crystal's Jack Kerouac bobblehead doll. Please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word this week comes from Meg Smith of the Lowell Kerouac Literary Festival. She comments on the likelihood that the prophet Jeremiah, like prophet Jack Kerouac, will someday be honored with his own bobblehead.
He should be so lucky.
Well, yeah, but when it comes to which prophet is the more widely published, let's just say Jack would likely trade bobblehead fame for Jeremiah's circulation. Or maybe not. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
You have words with him, and your features looking down. But these things, your heart can rise above. Once in a while he won't call.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering discerning patients a same-day tooth replacement solution for failed root canal treated or missing teeth. Information is available online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.